Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Today we will be receiving a briefing from the NPA from the team led by the DPP on their annual performance plans. DPP, you will have 10 minutes to make your opening remarks, which will be followed by 45 minutes of presentations.
So thank you, Chair. May I
the hand, Honorable Swart?
No, Chair, just to say I've got some connection issues my side, so my apologies if I'm in and out, and then tomorrow I've got the lockup. But thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Just maybe before you proceed, NDPP, any apologies?
Yes, Chair, please. Mr. Horner is unavailable today. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. The apology will be noted. Any other apology? None. Can we proceed? Welcome, NDPP.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. As indicated by the Chair, this morning we are presenting our report to Parliament as required in terms of the PFMA, but also the NDPP's report in terms of Section 22(4)(g) of the NPA Act, which goes beyond the compliance or the other issues that we are of the view would be useful for us to communicate to Parliament and to the people of South Africa through Parliament. Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, the NPA is halfway through implementing our 2020-2025 strategic plan. And you will note from the presentations that are going to follow that the plan is beginning to bear fruit. And so, you know, the purpose of this today, as I said, is to account and to share with the people of South Africa through Parliament what we have been doing. So this is a really important process, and as accountability is also one of the key strategic pillars of the NPA. So we take this very seriously. Honourable Chair, Members, this has been a very challenging period. Halfway into our strategic period. At the outset, I said that this was not going to be easy or quick, as nothing worth it ever is. But it has been a lot harder than expected. Very shortly into our performance, our strategic period, we were hit by COVID. But you will note that the steps and efforts that we are taking to rebuild the NPA to be a fit for purpose and future-proof NPA are indeed beginning to bear fruit. Colleagues will present the performance for the last year, and you will indeed note that there has been a marked improvement during this financial period. We will also update this committee on the six-month priority plan, which has resulted in impactful prosecutions that are being that have been instituted, and also significant asset recoveries. We listed some of the matters as has been publicly stated. The ID has enrolled 20 matters. They have charged 65 accused and obtained freezing orders of 5.5 billion, and also which includes the biggest restraint ever of 3.8 billion from the Gupta network. Next slide. This continues with some of the high-profile matters that we've enrolled during this period. In Gauteng, we seized assets worth 1.4 billion relating to the Kusile power station, and we are in the process of trying to extradite Michael Lomas from the UK, who was an Eskom contractor. Case with regard to the Free State Department of Agriculture, various charges relating to contraventions of the PFMA, including as well as fraud and money laundering, have been brought. In the Nulane investment case, there's a 520 million restraint order, also a Gupta-linked matter. The matter relating to Edwin Sodi, where we have about 300 million that's under restraint. And you can see the Free State housing matter, 500 million. And also we have finalized in the sense that the investigations are from our side are complete, but we are still awaiting some MLA requests so that we can proceed with the first leg of the Steinhoff matter. Next slide. Other notable cases, and Chair, we mention these matters because we mustn't forget that a very short while ago, these accused persons would not have seen the inside of a courtroom. So it's significant that these matters, although they may not appear to be big in terms of money or corruption charges, but the profile of the accused person makes them really impactful matters. And those cases also relate to the case against Batabile Dlamini as well as Dudu Mieni. You will note from the presentation, there will be more details given that the number of employees convicted of corruption has increased by 38.4%, and private sector convictions have increased by 39.5%. We also focus on a whole range of other important crimes that affect quality of life issues, particularly gender-based violence, sexual and gender-based violence, and conviction rates have increased. The conviction rate is 74.3% with regard to sexual offenses, femicide 94.3%, and intimate partner femicide 93.8%. You note the number of murder cases finalized. You also note the number of convictions with regard to these two murders. We've had 1,038 convictions. Chair, I must at this stage state that these are very, very high conviction rates, which show that cases that do come to court, the prosecutors are able, they are well investigated, and we are able to get convictions, of course, working very closely with our colleagues in SAPS. But the reality is that conviction rates don't always translate to people feeling safer. And we do recognize that there is a challenge with regard to detection, with regard to crime rates going up in our country, and we are trying to work very hard with the SAPS to be more focused in terms of dealing with quality of life crimes, for example, housebreaking, for example, dealing with serial rapist cases, and we can talk more about that in the course of questions or in the course of the presentation. Chair colleagues, we've also we've embarked on a number of strategic initiatives in order to ensure that we drive implementation of our strategy and that we are able to sustain this momentum. We have embarked on a number of strategic initiatives, and some of these will be detailed in the presentation later, but to highlight some of them, the setting up of the Office of Ethics and Accountability is at a very advanced stage. We are hoping that the minister will approve the regulations. In this regard, the Community Prosecutions Initiative is also beginning to gain momentum, and various capacity enhancement initiatives have also been undertaken. We decided last year already, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, that we needed to ensure that we were monitoring the implementation of our strategy, that we were reviewing the implementation of our strategy to ensure that we can also be held accountable. We decided that we will focus on three main performance areas. The one is the organizational performance review, which is what we're going to present today. That is our indicators in terms of the APP. But in order to ensure that we were making impact, we also embarked on, as I mentioned, a 6 month priority process where we decided on what we needed to prioritize for impact, given a whole range of issues, including resources, etc. And so we had the 6 month priority review process where we monthly ensured that we reviewed what we were doing, so that we were on track with delivering on these priorities that we had identified for a 6 month period. And you will note that a number of these cases have been enrolled in court. Also those relating to the Zondo Commission of Inquiry. And then in addition to that, we embarked on a number of strategic initiatives that I just talked about to ensure that we were able to build a fit for purpose NPA that was going to deliver on its mandate. Honorable Chair, honorable members, we've also embarked on a vigorous recruitment drive. And in the past 4 years, we have hired over 1,000 employees, particularly in much needed critical areas. The employment equity profile of the NPA has significantly improved. And I'm really proud to say that we have, we're trying really hard to improve this at the senior level in the NPA. And so we now have 65% of women in key management positions, and we appointed a number of women in DPP positions, special director positions, as well as the chief director finance and strategy are all women in the NPA. And I'm sure that this is going to translate into much greater and better performance in the coming year. No disrespect to the wonderful men in the NPA as well. Chair, we have embarked on serious budget advocacy. This has yielded results, and you'll hear later that we have been given additional budget for which we are grateful in the current MTEF, but further funding would be required in order that we could actually expand our partnerships and ensure that we deliver on our mandate. Also with the recent announcement of the president with regard to the permanency of the ID, there will be budgetary implications in that regard. Honorable Chair, honorable members, in order to ensure that we are able to deliver on this really important and challenging mandate, given all of the challenges that we face, we will need to have additional funding in the future. We are indeed delivering on what we have promised. There's still a long way to go, but the Portfolio Committee will note that there has been significant improvement from last year. And this, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, is not by default. It is very much by design and by working strategically, working with prioritizing matters for impact and ensuring that we are able to, whilst we're doing that, build a foundation for the NPA that will be able to sustain this and do so long after we have left the institution. Next paragraph. Next slide, sorry. Honourable Chair, we committed to enroll 9 what we referred to as seminal cases by the end of September. As part of our efforts to ensure that the country knows that the wheels of justice are turning. And we are very pleased that we were able to enroll those matters by the end of September. It doesn't mean that that's the end of it. We are ensuring, and we've made it very clear in the NPA, that we need to keep our collective foot on the accelerator to ensure that we continue enrolling cases, important cases, as we move into the future. There are a number of seminal cases that we enrolled, and they are all listed there. I'm not going to go through all of them. You can see them, the Estina Dairy Farm matter. There are various matters relating to SAPS, tender corruption, also in crime intelligence. Relating to PPE corruption, Transnet matter, we've had a match in the Transnet case, as well as private sector corruption where ABB has also been charged. You'll notice the other matters in Eastern Cape where the Chief Director of Community Safety and Liaison was arrested, the SA Express matter, and also the fraud matter relating to the Winnie Madikizela Mandela Museum matter. These are all important matters in different contexts. Next slide. Chair, with those few words by way of introduction, I'm going to hand over to Advocate Rodney de Kock, who will deal with the performance overview. Thereafter, Chair, actually at the beginning, I didn't introduce my team, which I should have done. Advocate Rodney de Kock, the head of the Deputy National Director, head of the NPS, will present the next part. There's a part on asset forfeiture, which Advocate Omar Rabadi-Rastava will present. And then there's the part on strategic initiatives as well as the budget, which Advocate Anton Duplessis will present. Advocate de Kock, are you ready to present?
Advocate de Kock, you have 45 minutes.
Yeah, it will be a cumulative between Advocate de Kock, Advocate Rabaji Rastava, and Advocate de Plessis. That's the full presentation. Thank you, Chair.
But it has to be done within 45 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Chair.
So thank you, NDPP. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. And good morning to members of the committee. Colleagues, please bear with me. I am suffering a bit with a cold. So from time to time, I may struggle a bit with my voice. The first part of our presentation relates to the overall performance of the MPA relative to its E&E indicators. I will deal with the part that speaks to the prosecution indicators, and Advocate Rabaji will deal with the part that speaks to the asset forfeiture indicators. But those indicators combined, the MPA achieved a 10 out of the 14 indicators that it set for itself. We submit that this is a significant achievement for the MPA. It's a 71% achievement, and it is an improvement from the previous year as well. So I think that we are on the correct path, and the performance indicators that we will discuss actually demonstrates that the MPA is moving in the correct way forward. We can move to the next slide. We just highlight the indicators that we have not achieved, 4 out of the 14. The conviction rate in complex commercial, a marginal non-achievement. The number of government officials convicted of corruption and offences related to corruption. The number of cases finalised with a verdict involving money laundering, and the value of recoveries relating to corruption or related offences. If we can move to the next slide. This slide, Honourable Chairperson and members, just unpacks those indicators that we have not achieved. And as I've indicated, mainly on the conviction rate one, you will see that there is a marginal underachievement. What is significant to note, however, is that we have finalized more cases of serious corruption during the reporting period. And I think that is also demonstrating that we're coming out of the challenges we faced during the COVID period. And the better way in which the prosecutors are preparing the cases. We had 344 matters finalized, and this is a 24% improvement on the previous financial year. We also, during this period, participated in the establishment of 18 dedicated specialized commercial crimes courts in collaboration with the Department of Justice. And I think this was an undertaking that was given by the minister before the commencement of the previous financial year. So I think that is also something that we need to celebrate, that we are moving to dedicate our resources to actually deal with complex corruption and complex commercial work. 209 persons were convicted of private sector corruption, significantly exceeding the target by 32%. And 130 government officials were convicted of corruption. Also an improvement, although we did not achieve the target that we set for ourselves, but we managed to increase significantly the number of people that were convicted. 86 cases involving money laundering were finalized, which is also a significant improvement of 42 cases over the previous financial year. If we can move to the next slide. Chairperson, this slide indicates some of the reasons for not achieving those targets. We speak about the one dealing with the conviction, the failing memory of witnesses, some uncertainty in the evidence, some contradictions, etc., leads to the result that courts may find in favor of an accused person. It also demonstrates, of course, that our system of justice is working, and that we are not achieving convictions at all costs, and that ultimately the role of the prosecutor is to present the evidence to the court, and it's for the court to decide whether or not a person is guilty or not guilty. The money laundering indicator I've dealt with already. The money laundering indicator we are taking on review within the prosecution service. This indicator is linked to other predicate offences in complex cases, and this impacts on our ability to finalise money laundering charges. So we are looking at how best we reorganise the work to focus on money laundering, and that is work in progress currently that we will take forward into our new strategic review within the MPA. I will not deal with the value of the recoveries. This is just a slide that gives an indication of the age analysis of some of those matters in relation to money laundering that I've indicated and I've spoken about. If we can move to the next slide. So some of the interventions that we are making to try and achieve our targets in relation to complex commercial crime, the expediting of high-profile corruption cases nationally and provincially, the focused attention on cases longer than 2 years on the court rolls, the prioritization of high-level corruption matters, and closely monitoring these cases are some of the strategies that the prosecution is currently employing. We have also organized ourselves in such a way that we want to ensure effective coordination across all business units within the MPA. And one of the additional measures we have put in place is to ensure that our directors of public prosecutions are actually operationally involved in ensuring that corruption cases and complex cases are prosecuted within their divisions. So we have put the onus on our DPPs and on our lead prosecutors to ensure that these cases are prioritized on our court rolls. I've dealt with the government officials, the money laundering, and Advocate Rabaji will deal with the value of recovery. Chairperson, this slide is just an indication of how we have performed in relation to corruption. Despite a decrease in new cases from 394 to 381, the number of convictions increased in corruption from 233 to 339. And so that is then depicted in the slide for the benefit of the members of the committee. If we can move to the next slide. This is the performance of our SECU courts as at the end of March 2022. Less than 10% of the SSU cases were disposed of within 9 months. There's a high backlog and outstanding cases impact on the availability of witnesses and the memory of witnesses and the credibility findings, of course. This is an issue that we have raised with the Chief Justice, and we also raised it recently in the NEEC meeting, where we've indicated because of the huge volumes of cases on our court rolls, as we are bringing more corruption matters onto the court roll, we will compound this challenge. So by the direction of the Chief Justice, we are to engage with the judge presidents of each of the divisions to make particular arrangement in terms of how we are going to manage and case process the corruption matters through our court, on our court rolls. So this is also work in progress, and it's one of the issues that will receive prominence in the strategic planning processes of the prosecution during November of this year. We move to serious violence and organized crime. During the reporting period, the MPA finalized 3,600 murder cases with a verdict. We obtained convictions in 2,787 murder cases with a conviction rate of 77.4%. This is above the target that have been set for us. So prosecutors are doing excellently in terms of the prosecution of murder cases. As far as the trio crime cases, the figures are also given on the slides, and it indicates that our performance for the current financial year, we finalized 1,038 trio crime cases with a conviction rate of 81.3%. As far as organized crime, we obtained a conviction rate of 95.9%. And as far as environmental crime, we obtained a conviction rate of 97.1%. Again, the indicators show that there's been progress across the board, particularly in the organized crime that has increased from 92 in the previous financial year to 96% conviction rate. If we can move to the next slide. So as part of the priorities of the prosecution, gender-based violence and femicide is one of our key priorities. It speaks to the way in which we deal with survivors and the way in which we deal with victims. And it also speaks to the great progress that we are making in terms of our Tutuzela care centers, where we are able to provide comfort and we're able to ensure that victims are treated compassionately by the system. So as far as femicide prosecutions are concerned, we achieve a conviction rate of 94.3%. And conviction rate in murder of intimate partner femicide prosecutions, we achieved a conviction rate of 93%. And our overall conviction rate in sexual offences was 74.3%. So these are significant convictions. Again, it's an indication that we are making great strides in terms of improving the manner in which we are dealing with violence against women and children and gender-based violence in particular. We've also addressed the issues regarding the DNA labs and the backlogs, and great strides have been made to ensure that the DNA results are received by prosecutors timeously for court purposes. So in the National Office of the NDPP, we are coordinating our efforts in this regard. And as a result of these efforts, we are able to sustain these prosecutions on our court rolls and to obtain these levels of convictions in our courts. If we can move to the next slide. So I've mentioned the operational Tutuzela care centers. The MPA has placed this in the center of our victim-centric approach. And we are putting a lot of efforts under the new special director to ensure that more Tutuzela care centers are established throughout the country, particularly within our rural areas. So this is just an indication of where we are currently. In the 2021-22 financial year, we now have 60 operational Tutuzela care centers in the country. There were reported cases of 34,500. We had obtained a conviction rate of 76%. So you will see that that conviction rate is slightly more than the overall conviction rate that we've achieved, which demonstrates that when a victim enters a Tutuzela care center, the outcome in court is also improved. We achieved 201 life imprisonments during this period. We achieved 106 convictions where the sentence was between 20 to 25 years imprisonment, and we achieved 378 convictions where the sentence was between 10 to 19 years imprisonment. I indicate on the right hand bubble the DNA progress that have been made between the MPA and the SAPS, Forensic Science Laboratory. We assisted to reduce the backlog related to court cases in court since October 2020. The SOCA unit consolidated and facilitated 16,000 DNA reports and identified 1,235 serial rapist reports from October 2021. As a result of this, the NDPP has directed that we, in collaboration with the South African Police Services, look at a particular initiative to deal with serial rapists because of the successes we're now having in our DNA analysis. We are picking up commonalities in incidents, and hence we are then able to identify serial rapists. So each director of public prosecutions in each division will have to drive those matters because these are the people that we need to get off our streets and we need to get behind bars. If we can move to the next slide. I think, Chairperson, this is the slide for Advocate Rabaji. So I will pause at this point. I may come back later. But Advocate Rabaji, thank you very much. I hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. I will speak to starting on slide 20, which is an NPA outcome, improved investor confidence in SA through the output of freezing of money and assets that are proceeds of crime. So on the two indicators that we report on for the period, the value of prison orders, we've exceeded by over 800% compared to the previous financial year, which is an excellent performance. And then as far as the second one is concerned, we are almost halfway through. In fact, we're just 2 months late in terms of achieving this target, in that in May, just 2 months after the end of the financial year, we obtained and finalized a matter, Department of Health matter in Gauteng, where 200 million has been recovered. So if we had just obtained that in March before the end of the financial year, I would have exceeded that target by 6 million. So we just need to understand that the recovery of proceeds is the last step in the asset forfeiture process. So it takes time for finalization of matters. So as I'm saying, as we are standing here, we've already achieved this target. But given the period within which we need to report on, it stands at almost 50% of achieving that target. Then if we turn to slide 21, Chairperson, I may indicate that, and you've raised the performance of AFU in previous sittings. We came from a low base in 2020 of achieving 28% of our targets, and we are sitting here already having achieved all the targets. So the focus then in AFU when I started in 2020 was to capacitate and to increase the level of capability in AFU. We started off with coming up with a high performance strategy and a plan. And to that extent, Chairperson, I'm very happy to report that we have employed and filled vacancies, including the chief financial investigator vacancies, which were standing vacant since 2009. Now we have employed over 120 people for a small unit as AFU. That's a lot of people that we have onboarded. We also have appointed regional heads in some provinces. You'll recall that since the inception of AFU, we had only about 4 regional heads and a bit of capacity at head office. So we have filled most of our vacant posts. And beyond that, in capacitating the unit, we have strengthened partnerships. You'll recall that we are in the middle of the value chain after investigations. Once there's a case made out for process of crime or instrumentality of crime, we can only then go chapter 5 or chapter 6, civil recovery based or conviction based. So we have completed co-location with the DPCI. We've got over 25 members of the police co-locating with us in all the provinces. And we've completed memorandums of understanding, and we also have got our people co-locating with FIC, which is very important so that they should be able to analyze, investigate, so that AFU can then proceed to do civil proceedings. Moving to slide 22, speaking to some of the significant cases. The NDPP has already alluded to one of the biggest cases, which is the Optimum Coal Mine and Colliery, which currently is standing at 4.2 billion. The valuation of this asset is still not yet complete. And related to this Optimum Coal Mine, it's the creditors' claim of 1.3 billion. That belongs to one of the Gupta lieutenants. We have also, we're happy to participate and work with the Lesotho National Government, where the Department of Treasury people committed fraud. There are some employees in the department committed fraud, and the money was then siphoned off to some bank accounts in South Africa. Within 5 months, we're able to preserve and forfeit the money, and 18 million has already been forfeited back to the Lesotho government. I was party to meeting with the Lesotho government when the money was repatriated, and the balance of the assets are still being pursued, and we'll still repatriate further funds back to Lesotho. We participated, you'll recall with other partners on COVID-related fraud investigations, and 114 million has already been returned to the UIF. Going to slide 23, Chairperson and honorable members, we have also then looked at other priorities that we needed to contribute to, corruption being the highest freezing orders that we've got at 7.75 billion for the payroll, and 180 million has already been recovered. We've done 33 confiscations and forfeitures to the value of 100 million, and we think that we have made a significant contribution in this regard. Also, Chairperson, turning to slide 24, contributed to making a dent in crimes committed in the following spaces: precious metals and stones, 76 million freezing orders at this stage. Drug cases, which really impact on the quality of life of our communities. We call them community irritants. We've already frozen up to 75.5 million. And fraud and theft, which ordinarily we do in the lower cost. We've done 58 freezing orders and 55 confiscations to the value of 81 million. Another significant contribution found in slide 25 is in the money laundering space. Again, we've got 24 freezing orders to the value of 71 billion. Illicit financial flows.
Somebody must speak to them.
To the value of 14 million that has already been recovered. 27 freezing orders to the value of 4.7 million. And we've also contributed significantly to the fighting of environmental crime that's plaguing particularly our provinces like Mpumalanga. 40 confiscation orders have already been brought and 2.4 million has already been recovered. Thank you, Chairperson. This is where I end the presentation. I will be able to answer questions later.
Thank you, Chair. I'll continue from, I'll take over as advocate, at Anton DPC. Strategic initiatives. And we touched on these in the opening and the in the introduction. I think
perhaps, Chair, you must write on the chat.
That while a lot of the focus and our reporting and our engagement with the media has been on responding to high-level corruption, seizing huge amounts of money, and dealing with priority crimes. But I think, as the National Director said at the beginning, what's important for members to know and for the public to know is that the progress we see now, and it's important to also remind ourselves that this progress is coming in the last financial year, which is the first what you could call normal year under our current strategy, because it's the first sort of COVID-free year we've had, is happening because of a lot of important initiatives that have been put in place. And what we're hoping to do with these initiatives is leave the NPA significantly better, in a significantly better place than what we found it, by the end of 2025. So as we said, we're midway through. I'm just going to touch on some of the strategic initiatives that speak to our efforts to try and create a trusting aid organization. And we're seeing the fruit of it now, but these are longer term initiatives that we hope will be important in terms of building the future of the NPA. So I'm going to just touch on some of them. The first one is NPA autonomy. Or independence, if you like. Those of you that have a chance to read the President's response to the Zondo report will see that this is an important issue for us. We've raised it in the context of the appointment process of the National Director, which we thought was an international good practice, and that's now been going to be included in legislative amendments, but also the broader discussions around strengthening the independence of the prosecution authority, which strikes a balance between the need for executive oversight, but also the need for financial and operational independence. This is a key discussion we're having. We did submit an affidavit to the Zondo Commission on this, and we've been doing a lot of work with the Department of Justice to make sure that this is something which there's momentum is maintained on this issue. Linked to that really is the restoration of NPA's credibility, and I think, honourable members, you've heard us speak many times in the last 2 years about our drive towards creating an IPAC organization, which is the independence, professionalism, accountability, and credibility. And there are a number of initiatives under that you can see in the annual report where we've given a lot of detail on it. But a key part of that was filling all our senior leadership positions that the NDPP spoke about. That's not only helped with our gender profile, but it's really helped bring stability to the organization, particularly at a provincial level. And that's really where the rubber hits the road in many cases. So having all our positions filled, I think, is quite an achievement which shouldn't go unrecognized. Of course, it's not just about filling positions, it's also about having the right people in the right positions. And it's not just about bringing new people, but it's also about creating organizational capacity. So when we, obviously one aspect of it is bringing in new positions, and we've filled a number of posts in the last year. You can see all of this reported in the annual report. Our aspirant prosecutors program, we're still bringing in between 300 and 400 new aspirant prosecutors every year. And in this financial period, 104 of those were provided with permanent appointments. So we are building the capacity of the organization from the bottom, but of course, also bringing in positions at a more senior level and making sure we're appointing people into the skill sets and the areas we need. Of course, it's not just about new skills, it's also about enhancing our existing skills. And I know there's a narrative out there, which is that the NPA doesn't have skills and that we're a hollowed out organization. I really want us to push back against that narrative. Of course, we need more skills. Of course, the nature and extent of the crime challenge we face.
We left 6 minutes, guys.
We have to do more, but we've really done a lot in terms of our capacity building. And one of the first things we've done in this strategic period is not just build capacity blindly. We've embarked on quite a comprehensive capacity review process where we're particularly benchmarking our capacity and our skills needed to deal with high-level corruption and complex corruption matters. And this benchmark is now completed, and that is informing the development of our bespoke training programs and capacity building programs for our staff. Next slide. So another mechanism that we've introduced that's very important, particularly in terms of our accountability pillar, is our own internal accountability capacity. And members would have heard us speak over the last years about our ethics and accountability mechanism, which is now the name is the NPA Office on Ethics and Accountability. As NDPP said, we're waiting for the minister to sign off on that, and then this will be staffed. And there will be a dedicated full-time capacity in the NPA to deal with internal ethics and accountability, both in a reactive but also a proactive way. And this is obviously vitally important in an organization like ours. We've said many times that we can't deliver on our mandate and keep ahead of the curve unless we innovate. So we've created specific innovation support capacity. The posts for those have been advertised, and we've embarked a number of partnerships with various organizations to make sure that our innovation drive remains in top gear. We've mentioned the community prosecution initiative that is taking off. We are appointing permanent capacity into this within all the divisions. And this is part of our victim-centered approach, and also making sure that we get a bottom-up perspective on the nature of the challenges being faced by the victims of crime and the community writ large in South Africa. Next slide. So another aspect which has been important is not just about actually doing good work, but allowing people to know that we're doing good work. And we've invested a significant amount of energy and capacity into our communications. I hope that members would have seen this paying off, both at social media level, but also formal engagement with the media. A number of op-eds that we've been writing, we've really been on the forefront of trying to drive the narrative. We don't always win, but that's a difficult game to play as a prosecution authority, where we can't try our cases in the media, but we've really enhanced our proactive communication, and we're quite proud of how far we've come with our communication departments and innovations around that. And then, of course, we can't do any of these things in a long-term sustainable way unless we have our most important asset being feeling that they are delivering, that they are, that they fit into the organization, their well-being is being taken care of. So we have developed a culture enhancement initiative that's being rolled out. There are many aspects to this, from anti-harassment policies through to the enhancement of our employment wellness program, which is key. And then the final one on this point is just the implementation of our electronic case management system, which is fully implemented now. All DPPs have been trained, and reporting on this is going ahead. And that's linked to the Department of Justice's priority around modernization. So I'll go to the next slide. We can skip this one. We can go quite quickly through these ones. The next slide, please. So, okay, the slide's not moving. Next slide, please. Okay, this one also, this is reported in the annual report. It's just to demonstrate that there is a lot of focus going on into the dealing with disciplinary hearings and moving those forward. The details are contained in the report, and we're happy to take questions. I know there have been some parliamentary questions from this committee on this, and we've answered specifically in writing, but there are the numbers. And you'll see in the financial year there were 80 misconduct and disciplinary hearings that were finalized, which out of a staff of 5,000, I think is probably on par with international trends. Next slide. Okay, and this is just a snapshot of our human resource capacity. You can see that the NPA staff numbers are over 5,000 are 5,164. Of those, 3,400 are prosecutors, and we are working hard to fill the vacant post. But also, even though you're seeing a vacancy there of 16% for prosecutors, some of those posts are being removed from our establishment and being repurposed so that we make sure that all the positions we have that are funded are used for the right priority areas. Next slide. Just a quick budget overview, colleagues. I won't spend a lot of time on this. I will give the high level. The good news is that the NPA is efficient at spending its budget, and we can honestly say we're spending on the right things. We spent 99.7% of our budget allocation last year. We did get a 74 million additional funding environment from Department of Justice for goods and services, but this had particularly for the payments of state attorneys. And the 0.28% underspending, which is very small, relates to machinery and equipment, and this is largely due to service provider delays on laptops and invoicing, and we've dealt with that issue. So it's pretty much almost 100% expenditure on our budget. And we have gone into the MTF process now requesting an additional budget allocation, as the NDPP mentioned, of 1.8 billion. And we've been quite scientific, I would say, in terms of how we've come up with that amount and in terms of determining what we need that money for. And we're happy to have a discussion with this committee about that. Next slide. This is just an overview of our budget. And you can see that the budget for the year was 4.5 billion. And there you can see the breakdown of the expenditure and the 99.7%. So I think that's it from my side. We've got just one section left and then we can wrap up.
Chair, sorry, Honourable Chair, I understand you were trying to reach us, but we couldn't hear you. I see our time is up, but just give me 2 minutes to conclude. Just on the grey listing, because this has also been in the media and in the public space. You know, FATF grey listing is a really important issue. And of course, we are at risk of being grey listed. But I just want to say that this is an all of government approach. And there are various government departments that need to do a whole range of things in order to avoid grey listing. And from the NPA perspective and the law enforcement perspective, we can really say that we have done a lot to avoid grey listing. It's really at this point, South Africa cannot afford to be grey listed. And it's important to note in this process that the review was conducted in 2019 at a time when there was no political will to deal with corruption or state capture or to deal with money laundering cases, etc. And since then, I can really say that what has happened is truly remarkable. For FATF to impose a grey listing on South Africa at this stage, I think will be counterproductive to what FATF is actually trying to achieve. Next slide, please. And finally, in conclusion, Chair, if we could move to the next slide, please. In conclusion, I'd like to say that we, as the NPA, we have our rebuilding efforts are beginning to yield results. As the cover of our annual report says, we are finally reaching solid ground. I think one of the indications that the NPA is beginning to, the wheels of justice are turning, is the increasing attacks that the NPA is facing, including comments like biased prosecutions. These are clear indication that those that fear accountability are trying to undermine the work of the NPA, and we would like to give our commitment to the people of South Africa that this has been a tough period, but we will not give up our fight for justice. Our five-year strategy, 2020-2025, was really crafted out of the ashes of state capture, and it burst into the clutches of the COVID pandemic, but it has really effectively guided the NPA towards sustainable impact. And the next 2 years is really going to be critical for South Africa and the rule of law. And I'd like to give our commitment to the people of South Africa that impunity is no longer a given. And the fact that the NPA is increasingly being attacked is a clear demonstration that that is the case. And from our perspective, we will always do what is justified in terms of the evidence, in terms of we will always adhere to the values in the Constitution. We are fiercely independent prosecutors. And as the NPA and as individual professionals, we will not compromise that for anyone. I thank you, Chair. And before I finish, my last point on the slide, but I do want to make this point. I do want to really thank all of the prosecutors for the really hard work that they've put in over the past year to deliver the kind of results that we have been able to. We know that we have still a mountain to climb, but with this kind of ongoing commitment and dedication, I have no doubt that we will make even greater strides in the next 2 years. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, NDPP. Members, you have received a briefing by the NDPP and her team on the annual performance plan of the NPA. I will now open this time for questions and comments or any of the two. I have Honorable Dennis Breitenbach, Honorable Iyako, and Honorable Stephen Swart in that order. And Honorable Jayla. Honorable Breitenbach.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm afraid I have many questions. First of all, to congratulate the NPA on the improvements. There are improvements, the obvious improvements, and it's very gratifying to see them. That being said, it's a steep hill to climb, and they've only just started. So notwithstanding the improvements, which I know have been hard won and not easy to achieve, and I acknowledge that up front, there are still a range of issues that are of concern and need to be dealt with. The first of them is, in my view, is grey listing. The NDPP says with some conviction that if the SATIF grey list us, they will not be achieving what they set out to achieve. Well, that may be so. The fact of the matter is that we're in great danger of being grey listed. In fact, it seems to be almost inevitable. I think we all realise what a serious issue that is for South Africa. And the fact of the matter is that the NPA did not meet its targets for prosecuting money laundering cases. SATIF has issued a deadline, so we need a little bit more information, please, on how the NPA intends to improve money laundering convictions. And what are the high-level interventions that they refer to that they will employ to improve the convictions? Then, despite increases in the specialized commercial crime courts, again, the NPA did not meet its targets for convictions of complex commercial crimes. And I think, less than 10% of the SSU cases were disposed of within 9 months. So it is so that the deflection of time does impact on witnesses' credibility, witnesses' memory, witnesses' availability. The case decays to both sides, both the prosecution and the defense, over time. So I need more concrete information about what will be done to ensure that these targets are met, especially bearing in mind the quite big increase in specialized commercial crime courts. Reference was made to the Steinhoff matter. It has been a long, sad, and dragged out investigation. The South African Reserve Bank has now acted, and rather alarmingly and noticeably, the NPA was absent from that action. It's been a long time, in my view, more than enough time to finalize at least some portions of the investigation. And again, you know, I'm an exponent of prosecuting people for what you have and get them held accountable. It's a luxury to prosecute for every single thing imaginable. And I really hope that that's not what's happening, because it's clogging a dead horse, really. General Labia told Parliament on the 19th of October this year that he had expected criminal prosecutions to have taken place, at least in some of the issues related to Sano. So what is the nature of the holdup? Then organized crime is alive and, well, unfortunately, and thriving in South Africa. The Global Initiative Against Organized Crime Risk Index has found that rather woefully we're not meeting expectations, that we have a strong legal framework when it comes to prevention and prosecution of money laundering and other crimes. But the problem is that, you know, our law enforcement agencies, of which the NPA admittedly is only one player, have failed to check the expansion and evolution of organized crime. The report refers to, and I won't refer to everything that they refer to, but they refer to the drugs trade in South Africa, which South Africa has become a transnational hub, firearms fueling organized crime and particularly gang violence, extortion, particularly in the construction industry, and kidnapping for ransom or extortion, which is alarmingly on the rise. Critical infrastructure theft, we've been stubborn blind as a country, and we see very little consequences. I would like to hear more detail about how the NPA plans to combat those and the other issues that are referred to in that report. Then let's just on to what Advocate Du Plessis was saying towards the end of his presentation. I'd like to hear more progress on the establishment of the Office for Ethics and Accountability. It's a very important office, especially when we all know that seriously compromised people continue to hold high office in the NPA. They promoted state capture, actively promoted it, and appear to be carrying on regardless. So I'd like to know what progress is being made, if any, to holding those people to account. The 3,600 murder cases finalized with a verdict, very well done, gratifying. But the police crime stats for the first quarter of 2022-2023 indicate that 71 people are murdered in South Africa per day. That gives you around 25,900 per annum. So 3,600 matters finalized is but a drop in the ocean. I think it's going to have to be improved and improved significantly. Then my old bugbear, the occupational specific dispensation. Again, I'm told by prosecutors within the NPA that it has been a raft of unfulfilled undertakings and unkept promises. What is the progress with occupation specific dispensation? It is completely destroying morale within your organization. What are you doing about it? And precisely, what are you doing about it? The NDPP says with admirable conviction that impunity is no longer a given. Well, I hope so. We would all be very happy if that were the case. I want to point out that it's not strictly true until people are convicted and are sentenced to imprisonment successfully. So they met their target to arrest important individuals. They've done that, and few people are happier than I. But arrests do not translate into successful prosecutions, nor do they translate into convictions. What South Africans want to see is accountability. If the NPA is fueled by fiercely independent prosecutors, which I hope it is, then you must act against those people who actively cooperated with and advanced gender or state capture within the NPA. We do not see that happening, and there are many South Africans watching that, many South Africans who are affected by it, and they're all waiting to see some sort of consequence. So I'd like more detail on what's happening there, please. And then I would like to join the National Director of Public Prosecutions in thanking prosecutors who are going to work every day and doing their best for what is largely a thankless task at this point in time, and express gratitude that they are working hard to improve matters. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach. Honorable Yako.
Nkosi Chair Kakhulu, I think Honorable Breitenbach took all my speaking time. I want to thank the NPA for their presentation. Again, I think I want to say that this one was not, and I've been lamenting about how high level the presentations have been, almost as a way to not make us understand what is truly happening. But this one was not as complicated or made to be complicated. So I want to say to them, thank you for the presentation. And a question I have, it's not a question as much as it's very broad. So one of the presenters made a comment about there's a high rise in crime, corruption. And I'm very curious if maybe the NPA has sat maybe with the investigating unit. and sat together and found a root cause of why, especially South Africans at a high level, are not respecting the rule of law, especially white collar crimes, especially political corruption, is at an all-time rise and still continuing to rise with the problems that we have as a country, and without them being respected in the part that they play in their prosecuting criminal activities. Have they had engagements where they investigate why it is that South Africans have this notion that they can get away with a lot of issues? So I'm not going to nitpick the report that they've given us. It's fine. I'm just saying, why is it that we're seeing a high rise of crime? And why it is now? Because we're finding out that the entities such as the NPA are now under so much stress in terms of they don't have enough capacity to withhold the amount of crime and corruption that is there, because it's rising so much. So I want to understand whether they've had a study to say, how do we combat this in a way that it is the NPA is respected as an entity that investigates crime to a level where they're prosecuted, to a level where people are actually accounting for the crimes that they have done and perpetrated. Not to scare people, but to say we exist and we are for the country. So that's the only question that I have. And Nkosi Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Yako. Honorable Steven Swart.
No, thank you, Chair. And I also want to join my colleague, Honorable Breitenbach, in saying well done to the NPA on improvements. Do you note that? Given the constraints that you are facing, well done to all the prosecutors that go out on a day-to-day basis under great, great challenges. And so we are grateful for the improvement. Obviously, there are a number of various aspects that constrain your greater improvements, and the situation is mammoth, crime fighting. A number of my questions have been covered by the Honorable Breitenbach, but just crime in general, I was actually going to ask that exact same question about the murders being approximately 25,900 per year with a 3,600. So when you start taking the number of murders, or even if you go right back to the number of dockets that are opened, and we understand NPA is one of the players all the way through, obviously it's a great concern. And I think the NDPP admitted that despite high conviction rates, people still do not feel safe in their houses. And that was elucidated further by the Honorable Breitenbach with that global report and some of the issues there, that
and the report noting as well, organized crime is becoming an existential threat to our democratic institutions, economy, and people. I think that's a general comment, and I'm sure this is a matter of great concern. The rule of law is under severe attack in South Africa, and whilst you're doing your best, you obviously are also dependent on other role players and their capacities. Now, in that line, I want to just touch on one or two further aspects. The Honourable Breitenbach did touch on grey listing, which is a great concern of us. She touched on the money laundering aspect, but I think the NDPP referred to a 2019 assessment, but in October 2021, the assessment stated that South Africa has convicted one person for terrorist financing since the last mutual evaluation and was prosecuting one case, which is inconsistent with its significant terrorist financing risk. That was October 2021. So we appreciate the money laundering aspect and the attention that's been given to that aspect, but clearly the terrorist financing part is a second leg. And can the NDPP give us an indication of what has been done in that regard to avoid grey listing? And I appreciate that it's part of a whole process. There are a whole number of bills that have been addressed, but there are 20 areas of weakness as identified in the mutual evaluation report, and one of which relates to the prosecutions. And I agree with you. There's no ways we can afford grey listing. It will raise our country's risk profile to unacceptable levels. So that's the one aspect. The second aspect relates to whistleblower protection that is highlighted in your report. I think you highlighted relating to the challenges with the safety of whistleblowers in the police matters, high-ranking police matters. But obviously, we're also aware that it was referred to in the Zondo Commission, and as well as President Ramaphosa's response to the commission and to those recommendations. What will the NDPP be doing to enhance the Office for the Protection of Witnesses? And does it also anticipate proposing legislative changes to the Protected Disclosures Act? The other area that I'd like to just focus on is the challenges that are highlighted in your report with the investigative directorate. And I think that relates to the working model and your reliance on the police SAPs to investigate the matters. And I think that is something we need to look at very carefully. Maybe here we need to have an understanding there's a challenge with secondment of investigators from SAPs, from Hawks, who are dealing with these high-level matters, but at the same time having to deal with their SAPs matters. And I think that there does need to be some legislative intervention here as to allow the investigative directorate an investigative capacity. And I understand there is task teams looking into this. There's a task team looking into the whole independence of the NPA, but we can't wait too long. And it could be that if the NPA comes directed to us, we could consider a committee bill to assist in that regard, to enable, given the large numbers of matters that the NPA is now facing from the Zondo Commission report, from the recommendations and what is being required there. It could be that we could assist in a far quicker method when it comes to assisting in that regard. So I'd like to hear what the NDPP has to say in that regard. The dependence on SAPs to assist the ID through secondments. I would also like to ask, there are obviously resource constraints, whether, and then there is a reference about the bank statements from financial institutions, mainly Transnet and Eskom, which are obviously delaying these matters. Surely we as Parliament can also exercise some form of, well, I'm not sure if we can, because it could be seen as intervening in the prosecutor's independence. But those are issues of concern where there seems to be delays in that regard. Now, the aspect of the absence of capacity to analyze, process, and present digital evidence. I'd like to understand what all the information that came from the Zondo Commission that went across to the MPA, to what degree was that collated, given the fact, and were analysts also transferred across? And what is the exact challenge when it comes to that absence of capacity to analyze, process, and present digital evidence? How can this committee assist in that regard? It's probably a budgetary issue. Chair, then I'd also like to just ask, there were issues relating to challenges that the MPA is faced with infrastructure and courts, court hours, court sittings, when it comes to obviously load shedding, when it comes to infrastructure. Would the NDPP like to elucidate a little bit on that? Because obviously that impacts on your targets, on your performance, and these are issues that are beyond your control. Even the basic issues such as legal aid, defense attorneys or not being in court, resulting in further delays of prosecutions. And then last issue relates to the budget. We are fully cognizant of the budgetary constraints, the 1.1 billion that was given over the medium term. But given the huge amount of work, we would do everything to ensure that the NPA is properly capacitated to do its work properly. And that is an issue that was touched on by Advocate Duplessis. Then the cooperation with the State Attorney's Office, there seems to be concerns where matters are dealt with civil litigation against the NPA, and there, can you highlight those challenges where pleadings might not be filed in time, leading to judgments against the NPA in civil matters, which arise from your criminal matters? So that, those are the issues I'd like to raise. I again want to thank you for your hard work. Keep it up. We are fully supportive in your fight against crime and to establish and maintain the rule of law in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Maseko Tshwela.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning. And also, good morning to the NDPP and the team. Chair, I want to also echo my voice when it comes to really thanking the NPA for the progress on the work that they are doing, though there is still a lot that I feel that there are some other areas where they still have to work hard. But for what they have done and the progress, we just want to, yes, applaud them. I have only a few questions to tell person because most of the question has been covered. But let me just also thank the Advocate Batoi and the team on the employment of women, 60%, as she alluded on her presentation. But also I wanted to add to say, I don't think that it is the issue of numbers. The office of the NPA must make sure that they give support to those women and also make sure that they are capacitated in terms of tools of work to make sure that they do their work, and it's not the issue of coming back and saying women are not competent and all that. So please make sure that those women that you have employed, they get the support that they deserve. And also, I think I also have another question, Chair, on the issue of kidnapping for ransom. The NPA is reporting for 5%, and there is an increase, Chairperson, in that area. So I just want to find out as to how are they going to improve on this one, because it is one issue that is very, very serious also that needs an attention. But lastly, the last one, Chairperson, it is the issue I just want the NPA to confirm this issue, if it's true, because on the media, Chair, there is a family, and South Africa is really mourning baby Buhabo from Gauteng. That girl was brutally murdered by this guy. And the report, Che, the media is reporting that the NPA, this guy is not for the first time doing this. He was on bail. He killed a nine-year-old, in fact, he raped one nine-year-old girl again. And the NPA did not oppose the bail. So I just want to find out if it's true what is reported. Why did the NPA not oppose the bail, especially on this issue of the GBV? We are trying to work hard to stop this issue of GBV chairperson and try to uproot it from our community. And we find reports like this. If this is true, I want the team, NPA advocate Patoy and the team to tell us exactly, is it true that they did not oppose bail on this guy? Now this guy has killed Buhabo. And what the team that was working on that case, what's going to happen if the matter is true, Chair? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Neighbor Tosan.
Thank you, Chairperson. Is the interpreter audible?
If she can raise her voice a bit.
Okay. Good morning and thank you, Chairperson. Good morning to everyone on the platform. Thank you to the NPA for your presentation. I would also like to join my colleagues and thank the NPA for a lot of improvement, and thank you for the work that the NPA still continues to do. Just a few questions. I'm hoping that I'm not repeating. I'm in load shedding, so in between I had to change devices. With regards to one slide, I think it's slide 11. No, okay, well, I'm not sure. It says the government officials convicted where the target was not met, 123 out of 232. I didn't see, and I'm not sure if you've already explained it, why is it lower? Yes, there's an increase in the number of convictions, but why is it only 130 out of the target of 232? And then the TCC centers, the Tutuzela centers, I see that in 21-22, 60 TCCs have been operational. Now I'm curious if there's a new number that you have added for the new financial year. Just like to know if there's an increase in the targets. Then vacancies in Northwest. It's very high vacancy rate. So I just want to know those positions that are vacant, is it critical positions or where are those vacancies within the Northwest? Then people with disability, what is your current percentage? I see you give the number of women but not disabled. And then also, what is the number of youth currently who are employed in the NPA? The DNA issue, I know that previously it was said that the DNA testing was at a backlog. So I just want to find out, where is the backlog? Has there, you know, been any improvements in that? But, you know, so is there a big backlog currently or is it moderately okay? And then the AFU's target was not met. What are the interventions that the NPA will employ into that area. With regards to culture changes, the Cultural Changes Program, I believe the NPA had a webinar on racial inclusion. I'd like to know whether there's an update. Did that webinar assist with solving some of the issues in the NPA with regards to with regards to that? And that's all for now, Chair. My other questions have been covered. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I close the video for better bandwidth? I have some few questions to ask before we allow the NPA to respond. Thank you very much. Who extended the lease of the building to a month-by-month contract? And what are the financial implications? If you do not have the answer, maybe we will appreciate if you can give us, especially the financial implication part in writing. And with respect to the issue of the building and the increased number of people that are occupying the building, and as a result, you need more space, have you thought of the hot desk approach to try and ensure that you innovate around the issue of space within that building? That would be the other question. And then how long will the process of finalizing the permanent structure of the ID, how long will it take to finalize that structure for the ID? Because we think that since the president has already made mention of the fact that the ID will be made permanent and you have been working on the structure, so we want to have the project plan as to when do you anticipate that that structure would be finalized. And what is your approach or what is your strategy in dealing with the use of outdated technology? We do understand that this is not only your problem, but it's a big problem within the security cluster, and that is going to make the fight against crime and corruption to be a mockery, especially that Honorable Swart has also made a reference to the issue of terrorist financing. That would also need to fight that and to track that you need up-to-date technology. So what is your strategy in dealing with that? I think Honorable Breitenbach has raised the issue of money laundering and has raised the issue of the differences between NPA and Hawks with respect to the stain of matter. Have you received any donations from the German government, or what nature of support have you received from the German government, and whether you have received any donations besides the German government, if they have given you any? And then the issue of the aspirant prosecutor program, it's something you need to think about. It's generally my view that largely, people who would apply to be aspirant prosecutors would be in the range of young people generally. They're starting with their careers. Whether you should not try and link the aspirant prosecutor problem with a youth development strategy. And to that extent, whether it would not be important to ensure that the aspirant prosecutor program is accredited by the LPC, because young people, they might want to move to other careers in the near future, whether NPA should not ensure that they have a program that is accredited, even if they want to join the sidebar and the bar they might not need to start from the beginning to do that. It's just my thoughts. Maybe you can have your preliminary responses, NTPP, around that program. One of the issues is that you have spent 99.7% of the budget, which is commendable, but to achieve 71% of the results, would you say that is the best efficient use of financial resources? And then coming to cases, how many of the 202 persons or entities recommended for prosecution by the Zondo Commission are currently dealt with by the NPA Task Force? Of the 202 being addressed by the task force, how many have been arrested and brought before court? Of the 65 accused that are enrolled for prosecution in 20 cases, how many are on the list of the 202 persons recommended for prosecution by Zondo Commission? Of the 27 cases recommended by the Zondo Commission for recovery of assets, how many are being dealt with by the Asset Forfeiture Unit? How many have preservation orders, and how many have been forfeited to the state? May you please provide in writing the list of case numbers and the values involved, and identify the corrupt contracts or bribes that the order relates to? And then has the NDPP considered and come to a conclusion on whether any member of the NPA contravened Section 32, Subsection 1 of the NPA Act, and whether the NDPP has taken any steps in terms of Section 4, Subsection 1 of the NPA Act against any person? Those are my questions. NDPP, I think you have we have asked quite a number of questions. Can we give you 8 minutes so that you can caucus and distribute those questions amongst yourselves?
Did you say 8 minutes, Chair?
Yes. Which will form as which will also be a comfort break for members.
Okay.
Comfort break for members. So we will come back at 10 past 11. So it's 3 minutes past, so that's 7 minutes, yes, 10 past 11. Thank you. Welcome back. NTPP, are you ready?
We will respond now. Advocate de Kock will go first.
No, just before you respond.
Sorry, Chair, I can't hear you.
Just before you respond, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Just before you respond, there is a lot of interest that has been shown by some members
louder,
on the platform. On the grey listing, they feel that I might not have given you enough time to explain the grey listing. If you think that there is anything that you are not able to say, maybe you can start by just speaking about grey listing for some few minutes, because it's something that is topical and is of serious interest to South Africans and to the rest of the world. So if you feel that there are certain things that you could not be able to say because of time limits, I will give you the time before we proceed to the responses to the questions.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'll deal with it at a very high level, and then I'll ask Advocate de Kock to say a few things in this regard, because he's been managing the process at the straddling the strategic and technical levels, where the progress is being monitored in terms of the action plan that was developed by various entities in government that were required to do various things to try to avoid grey listing in the past year. And there's, in this regard, as members are aware, there's law enforcement, there's a whole range of government entities that are required to do various things in terms of the various immediate outcomes of the FATF review process. These include, of course, law enforcement, the NPA, the DPCI, but also includes various entities in the financial sector, like the Treasury, like the Financial Intelligence Center, Reserve Bank, etc. So the FSA, there are various entities that have to do all kinds of things. So Advocate de Kock can speak a little bit more about that. But just to say from a high level, Chair, we have been very closely, Treasury has now taken over the coordination function. But the entire action plan is being very closely monitored in terms of what we needed to do to try to avoid grey listing. Now, some of the issues that have been raised by members relating particularly to prosecution of money laundering, standalone money laundering cases, as well as the terror financing matters. Just to say in that regard, Chair, we have a number, if you look at the annual report, there's a number of money laundering cases that have been prosecuted. But these are predominantly where the person that is responsible for the predicate offense is also the money launderer. So it doesn't deal with your so-called professional money launderers. So for example, dealing with banks or estate agents or lawyers who utilize their trust funds, etc., to launder money. That's where South Africa has been found to be lacking. And in this regard, Chair, and this relates both to money laundering, but also terror financing, where the financial sector plays a very, very important role. The Financial Intelligence Center, in particular, working with law enforcement, plays a crucial role, together with working with the private sector, with the banks, that it's only with good financial intelligence that law enforcement would be able to properly deal with these matters. And so one of the questions that was raised in terms of what I think it was by Honorable Breitenbach, was what are the high-level interventions? And what we have been doing is engaging with the FIC and also looking at engaging in the various fora like SAMLIT, where the banks are also represented, and it involves a whole lot of private sector as well as government entities. We really have to find a way where the financial intelligence is better with regard to these issues so that law enforcement can have good analytical reports and act on them. And we have been engaging particularly with Advocate Kanyile in the FIC to look at how we could better get a better product so that law enforcement can act on it. But I'm going to leave it at that point. I'm going to ask Advocate Kok to say a few things about this, and then we can move on to responding to the questions.
Thank you very
Advocate
much.
Advocate Kok, are you? Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, NDPP. Chair and members of the committee, I think that it's important to recognize, firstly, that our response to the mutual evaluation report is not just an NPA response. It's a whole of government response. And this response is led by National Treasury and by the Financial Intelligence Center of the country. The NPA is responsible largely for three of the outcomes in terms of that report. Many of the outcomes are talking to the financial sector and talking to regulations applicable to both the banks and to other industry players that's dealing with cash, and that's dealing with flows of money, and that's dealing with trust funds and trust accounts. So a lot of the work that is relevant to the FATF outcomes speaks to the financial sector, and hence the legislation that's been tabled by Treasury in that regard to try and address many of those gaps that were identified by FATF in its evaluation of the country. As far as the prosecution and investigation is concerned, this is where the MPA and investigating authorities have an active role to play in terms of addressing those particular outcomes, as well as the asset forfeiture unit and asset recovery disciplines within the state machinery. We also have a role to play in terms of international cooperation, mutual legal assistance, and the extraditions that happens within the country. So within the organization, we have, firstly, as the NDPP indicates, we are working very closely with the FIC. We are working very closely with the DPCI, and a work stream has been created particularly to address the issue of intelligence, investigations and prosecutions. As a result of the work of that work stream, we've identified that since the evaluation report was done in the country up until the end of March, when we submitted information to FATF, we have finalized 534 money laundering cases within South Africa. Now, the importance of that 534, it speaks to the collaboration between the FIC, the DPCI, and the prosecution. So a lot has been done to address particularly the issue of money laundering, but more needs to be done to address the issue of standalone money laundering. So that is where we charge individuals on money laundering counts as standalone counts, as opposed to charging individuals on money laundering charges in relation to cases that involve other offenses, which we call the predicate offenses. So I did speak about that earlier. Then at the moment, we have an additional 72 money laundering cases on our court rolls. And this is the challenge that I identified that we spoke about within the operational meetings of the directors of public prosecutions, that these are the cases that are linked to other offenses. And that is the reason why we sometimes have difficulty in getting those cases finalized speedily. But it still remains a priority for us to do that. So as far as the other work that we are doing as in the investigation and prosecution of money laundering offenses, the MPA has created the money laundering desk within the MPA that coordinates the work of all our business units, including the asset forfeiture unit. And some of the information that has been provided to the committee in terms of the recoveries to date, particularly recoveries that's linked to state capture, has already been furnished to the PATF in terms of some of the successes that the country has gone through. The second important feature that we must recognize is the creation of the ID. Now, when the PATF evaluation took place, the ID had not been set up. The ID was still in an early stage of being set up. And so what has happened since then is that there's been a significant amount of money and budget allocated in respect of the creation of the ID. And one of the main issues that was addressed in the PATF evaluation was our inability to deal with corruption, serious complex corruption, and the inability to deal with state capture. So I think that in the interim, we have submitted to FATF as part of the response of the country that the ID has done significant work in terms of taking that forward, and cases have been forwarded to the FATF to demonstrate actual work that's been done in this terrain. So the evaluation hub is sitting within the FIC, and on a quarterly basis, the directors of our various departments, the directors general, are meeting in the interdepartmental committee. And at the last interdepartmental committee that is chaired by the Treasury, the MPA was commended for the work with the DPCI that has been done in the interim in the last 2 years. So the FIC in particular, and the presentation that was presented, was that we've made great strides in investigating and prosecuting, and we've demonstrated that too by the evidence that we've submitted to the PATF. Of course, the PATF will have to do the evaluation, which I understand will happen in January, where all of this can be tested. But ultimately, we are confident as law enforcement that we are doing significant work to speak to the outcomes relevant to investigation of prosecution. As far as the terror financing aspects are concerned, these matters are led by the intelligence agencies of our country. The MPA participates in this work stream. So there's another work stream that deals with terror financing. And we have had a significant conviction since the last FATF evaluation. The one was the state versus B2C, and another, the twin brothers and South African citizens that were charged with 12 counts relating to the contravention of South Africa's primary counter-terrorism legislation, the so-called Pokdara Act. This was specifically in relation to a conspiracy to carry out terrorist activities in South Africa and an attempt to leave South Africa to join a terrorist entity named the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant in Syria. These accused were convicted. The other important matter that we have subsequently also obtained a conviction is the state versus H.J. Knussen. Knussen was a retired pastor and former South African National Defence Force member, was planning terrorist activities and a coup d'etat between December 2018 and 2019. Knussen, the general of the right-wing group called the Crusaders, was accused of planning an insurrection and the genocide of South African citizens, particularly black South African citizens. More than 2 years after his arrest, his trial started on the 28th of April, 2022. Hefty sentences were handed down, and he was given two life sentences of imprisonment for terrorism-related charges. There is another significant matter which we believe also will help us in the new evaluation, And this was an application by the United States of America for assistance in relation to the so-called Black Axe scam, an internet dating scam. These suspects were arrested in Cape Town on the 19th of October 2021. The U.S. Secret Service were investigating this matter, and we ensured the successful extradition in relation to this particular matter. And the amounts involved in this particular scam that speaks to money laundering is 1.2 million euro. Internationally, they are looking at 75 suspects, 49 properties, and that Interpol notices have been issued in relation to at least seven accused. So these kind of incidents, and the reason why I highlight this is because this is what the FATF evaluators would want to see. They would want to see how we cooperate with our international counterparts, what measures we are putting in place in order to deal with it, and what case studies we can present to them to demonstrate the work that we do. So I highlight these three as important ones in relation to those areas that the members have been asking us about. So as we speak, I think that we have recognized, and FATF has just concluded a plenary session in France. The MPA participated in that plenary with other colleagues from the Reserve Bank, from Treasury, from the Financial Conduct Authority, and from other South African institutions. It is clear to us from our evaluation of where we are at the moment that our country is in a much better position now than what we were in 2019. Firstly, we are much better organized as a country to respond to the issues that were identified as gaps within our financial system. Secondly, we have developed legislation that hopefully will be passed before the next evaluation happens. And thirdly, we have reorganized our law enforcement agencies to cooperate better with each other. And we depend on the Financial Intelligence Center to give us a better quality reports that provides an analysis and that will help law enforcement to investigate those matters. And then fourthly, I think that the Zondo Commission and the fact that the country and the president appointed Judge Zondo to look at the question of corruption in our country, what went wrong, that work has been completed. That was not completed at the time that the FATF did the evaluation. And then besides that, we now have a comprehensive response that the president will table in parliament that will indicate the steps the country is taking to address corruption in particular. But I think a lot of the initiatives that we've identified broadly within the scope of that work also speaks to some of the issues that were identified by FATF as part of deficiencies within our system. So I think if we look holistically at the progress that we have made, we've made significant progress in terms of that. Whether or not we are going to be grey-listed will depend on the evaluators and the way in which the evaluators receive the information and the case studies that we present to them. But we are confident that in the manner in which we are organizing ourselves now, we will be able to put up a good case to the evaluators when they meet with us in January. So, Chairperson, I'd like to end on that note. This is a very complex area and a very technical area of the work. To address this adequately, one can provide written responses on all of the IOs, because that's the way we should do it. But I've tried to just highlight some of the key initiatives that the MPA is currently busy with. So thank you very much, NDPP.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Advocate de Kock. Chair, if we may proceed now to deal with the specific questions. Thank you. Advocate de Kock, you may proceed first, please.
The next question, and there's been a number of questions relating to the sign of matter. I think that we would like to address that one immediately as well. Just to say to the chair and to the committee that as far as the Steinhoff case is concerned, the MPA and the DPCI have put a great effort into trying to get this matter to the state of readiness required for the purposes of a criminal prosecution. Our organizations have left no stone unturned in addressing this. And at the high level, at the national level, we also meet to receive reports from the prosecution team. So I want to reassure the members of this committee that Steinhoff is getting all the necessary attention that he deserves, and that soon we will see the results of that. The challenge we, of course, have is that we cannot speak too much about what we are doing as far as Steinhoff is concerned. I will highlight some of the issues that we are busy with. But again, members of the committee, I just say that we cannot delve in to too much information regarding the particular case. Prosecutors are now focused on ensuring that the required evidence that is necessary to support a successful prosecution of the envisaged preferred charges are being secured. A number of outstanding witness statements are being dealt with. We are assisting the investigators to compile further evidence in this regard. There are a number of outstanding chain evidence that still needs to be gathered. And then there's the completion of outstanding mutual legal assistance requests from foreign jurisdictions that we also need to finalize. As far as the PwC auditor's report, we have received updated reports from the PwC, but just an indication of the complexity involved in this particular matter. The PwC report has not been finalized as we speak. The prosecutors have engaged with the PwC in terms of its audit and its audit findings, and there is some interaction still that is required in terms of the PwC. As of to date, 329 statements have been filed in the case docket, including affidavits from the various Steinhoff investors, the CIPC registration documents of companies incorporated, and various other documents that had to be sourced from the stock exchange and from the external auditors of Steinhoff. There is still much work to be done in terms of the mutual legal assistance application. Two requests for mutual legal assistance have already been submitted to two European countries. I will not name the two European countries, and that they are still outstanding mutual legal assistance requests that are expected from seven countries in which we urgently need to obtain information from them. We are also looking at certain people acting as two or four witnesses in this particular matter, and consultations are happening as we speak in relation to that. The prosecution team has also engaged the assistance of the private sector to support the work of the prosecution and investigation team, and we are awaiting a particular report from experts that have been assigned to assist the prosecution team with this matter. A draft indictment has been prepared, although the final decision as to who will be charged, how many accused will be in this particular matter, and the final indictment will still have to be finalized. The asset forfeiture unit is involved in terms of the work of the AFU in this matter and are working closely with the investigators and the prosecutors that have been assigned to the case. So overall, we have said to the team that we need to move this case along as speedily as possible. One of the initiatives that we have recently decided upon is that this team will be located together so that they can work with each other on a daily basis. And premises have been identified in Gauteng for that purpose, to ensure that the team can do everything in its power to move along. We are also in consultation with the German authorities to see what additional support we can get from the German authorities to deal with our case, particularly those citizens of Germany that we are interacting with. And there are one or two people that are critical to this investigation that we are interacting with. So to come to the issue of the DPCI, we did have two recent meetings with the DPCI. The one was over the weekend, and the DPCI has confirmed that as far as they are concerned, they are on exactly the same page as the prosecutors in this matter. The question was particularly raised with them whether there's any disagreement in terms of the approach that has been followed, and we've received confirmation from our DPCI colleagues that there's no disagreement to that effect. Our understanding was that previously there was an issue raised where there was a suggestion that there could be a prosecution on a share trading issue, and that had been raised some more than a year ago. But subsequent to that, the tribunal that was seized with that particular matter ruled that share trading issue was, in fact, the Financial Conduct Authority's decision in relation to the share trading issue was overturned by the tribunal. So that is the only thing that we could think of that potentially could have been prosecuted. But as we speak, the DPCI and the prosecutors are in alignment in terms of where we are with the matter. And the teams are working very hard to ensure that this case is brought to court within the shortest possible time. As far as the Reserve Bank is concerned, the Reserve Bank and the DPCI, in terms of the investigation of the exchange control regulations, have been in touch with each other. I believe that a further meeting is going to be held with the Reserve Bank to understand whether or not the Reserve Bank wishes to refer criminal charges or investigation to the DPCI. That meeting has not happened. In the interim, the officials dealing with the matter have raised the secrecy provisions relevant to the work of the Reserve Bank, but those ongoing discussions with the members of the DPCI are currently taking place with the Reserve Bank. So, Chairperson and the committee, that is the input that we can provide in relation to Steinhoff. NDPP, I hand back to you.
Edgar de Kock, if you could deal with all of the questions, or do you want a few minutes whilst one of your colleagues takes some questions, and so that you can get your thoughts together. So if you can ask Advocate Rabaji to deal with the, I think there was one or two questions regarding asset recovery, and then perhaps I'll come to Advocate Duplessis to deal with some of the matters that fall under his scope of work, and then come back to you, Advocate de Kock. Advocate Rabaji.
Thank you for the question. I think the question came from an honorable member, Nivot Brachan, regarding the value of recoveries relating to corruption or related offenses, and what AFU is going to do as far as not achieving that target. Now, a lot of interventions have already occurred. As I said, we have got over 25 DPCI investigators co-locating with AFU. We did say that that's a game changer. It's going to help us to speedily deal with investigation of process of crime to ensure that there's no dissipation of assets. So that has been completed. We've also are working closely with the task team, where again there's DPCI colleagues as well as our prosecution colleagues, because this relates to corruption or related offenses. So whatever strategy that the task team has put in place, as well as the ID dealing with corruption is concerned, AFU will then be able to deal with the matter. And then there was a question from the chairperson relating to out of the 26 recommendations made by the Zondo Commission reports, how many have we dealt with? And I think the chairperson said we must submit a response in writing indicating the case numbers, but we've dealt with well over 13 matters out of the 26. So that response will be forwarded in writing. Thank you. There are a lot of interventions, and some of them, of course, is overall for asset forfeiture to achieve their targets, and the others it's relating to FATF recommendations. You will recall that the FATF recommendations relating to asset forfeiture is immediate outcome number 8, which deals with the fact that asset forfeiture, at the time when they did assessment in 2019, had not done any recoveries relating to state capture. So where we are standing now, where we are over 13 billion in terms of frozen assets. So we have intervened, but we've also signed a memorandum of understanding with the DPCI, SARS, and FIC relating to unexplained wealth orders initiative. We have seconded 4 senior members of the AFU to work at SARS regarding this initiative. So that will in a way address fighting corruption as well as FATF recommendations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Abaji. If I could hand over to Advocate Du Plessis to deal with questions, and then I'll come back to Advocate De Kock and then finalize any outstanding questions after that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'll try and flick through the questions as quickly as I can. And then if there are any left out, we can come back. So the first one was on the progress on the Office of Ethics and Accountability. Indeed, as we stated, a vitally important initiative in the organization. The progress is, there's been extensive progress on it. We've done the organizational design process. We've done a significant amount of internal engagement, trainings, and preparations for it. Unfortunately, we cannot finalize the process and appoint the new staff into place until the regulations have been signed off on. And we're at the final stage of that. We're hoping to do that certainly before the end of the year. I know the minister has also committed to this. Once those are in place, then there will be a process to appoint the new leadership and the new team. And of course, it's a transition process because we have the internal management unit that will be, the OEA will essentially be taking over from, but we have to transition this process. There's been a lot of engagement with the bargaining council. So it's been a complicated process, but it's very well advanced. And we're hoping that from early next year, the structures will be put in place for all the reasons that were mentioned. The second question raised was around the deputy director's salary, and it's not really just an OSD process. It's a little bit broader than that. And we're fully aware of how demoralizing this issue is, and we've been working on it for a very long time. And as you said, there's ongoing litigation that's happening in this matter. So there are a number of moving parts. But what we've done is we've engaged with our counterparts in DPSA. We have their concurrence for the proposal that we've made for a new salary dispensation for these affected colleagues. And these are deputy directors of public prosecutions and certain chief prosecutors. This proposal has been discussed extensively with the team that's been set up. We have an internal team that's been working with them. We meet on a regular basis, communicate with them. But unfortunately, at this stage, the final decision is not within our hands. It is a decision that has to be signed off by the Minister of Finance. And we have been engaging, as I say, with the various counterparts. We have concurrence from DPSA. We are now engaging with the DG of Finance and with the Minister. And our Minister is also very supportive. So that's the next step, is to take the proposal, the final proposal we now have, back to National Treasury. And obviously that's happening in the context of a a very complicated wage negotiation and broadened discussions around the issue of the OSD, if you like, and the LP10. So it is a complicated situation, but we do feel that we've made progress on it. And I think the perception that was created that nothing's been done about that is not the correct one. In fact, it's been a major priority for us. And it unfortunately does involve sign-off from other departments, which I've explained. The question of whistleblowers and asset forfeiture, that's vitally important. And I think you would have seen in the president's response to Zondo on Sunday night that the decision has been taken, that there will be a review not only of the witness protection, but also the Protected Disclosures Act, to make sure that both of these are bolstered in light of the recent experiences that we have and the priority that has to be given to whistleblowers. There's an engagement, of course, with civil society actors on this, and we're part of that team that's working on that legislative reform. There does need to be a decision taken as to the final placement of the witness protection unit. As you know, it's currently based within the NPA under the Act. It theoretically should be within the Department of Justice. That discussion is ongoing, and I think once the amendments to the legislation are made, we'll be in a better position to decide. But at the moment, witness protection is still being managed by the NPA. We still have 100% performance achievement in that space. But the issue of witness protection, although at the moment it sits outside the NPA's mandate for reasons you know well, it is something we speak about regularly, and we know how important this is. It's not just about protecting our witnesses. We have to move the process forward on witness protection, and that will on whistleblower protection, and that will involve not just government responses, but of course also the engagement with the private sector. I'm going to move on to I'll ask Andrea who will come in on the digital lab question asking me. The other question that I'll pick up on was the people with disability and youth, and that's also a vitally important question. The statistics, I don't think, tell the full picture. I can give them, and there are 24 people with disabilities that have been disclosed within the NPA, and we have a campaign around that, and that's not a high percentage, but it certainly is something that we take seriously, and we engage on a number of initiatives around that segment of staff. The question of youth is very important. I think that's defined as under 35. And we're quite proud to say that 21% of the NPA is regarded as falling within that category. But in line with the minister's commitments to modernization of the organization and to bringing younger people into our ranks, we're certainly going to be ramping this up. We don't have specific targets yet, but within our APP for next year, we're going to be targeting youth employment extensively. And it's not just through our aspirant prosecutors program. It's also in terms of how we engage with our broader recruitment strategies. We need to bring more youth into our organization. But at this stage, 21% is the figure. The question that was asked around cultural enhancement and the racial inclusion program. The webinar, that was an ongoing process. It wasn't an end in itself. And yes, it did have a really important impact because, of course, cultural enhancement it cuts across so many areas. But racial inclusion and the question of racial diversity in the organization is vitally important. So that is a key pillar of it. That was one element in a broader process, and there will be further seminars of that nature. And if you'd like more information, we can send you the write-up of that seminar if you'd like. The chair, you asked some very important ones. I don't want to rush too much, but let me quickly go through the ones you spoke about. The question of space and innovation around hot desking. I think the one of the things that COVID did show us is that we need to do more in this regard. It is a bit difficult with the nature of some of the work that prosecutors in particular do and the engagements they need to have with witnesses and counterparts. So hot desking is more complicated, but certainly in the context of our head office staff, it's something we're looking at. We're looking at major innovations in terms of how we use our space to save on budget.
I'm referring to the head office.
Are you referring to the head office? Thank you, Chair. Okay, so in the head office, yeah, we also are looking into that process. We're also at the moment looking at the future of the building that we're in terms of expanding the building or discussions that we're having with the Department of Justice on that. As you know, the owner of our building is in business rescue, so there are some complications in terms of how much we can engage with them on that. But what we are doing is making sure that all staff have a space to work, and hot desking is one of the options that we are exploring and taking lessons from the COVID era. The permanent structure of the IED, of course, that's a highly pertinent question in light of what happened on Sunday night. As you would have seen from our press statement, we this is a really big game changer for the NPA. It's something we've been working hard on for some time. And so the announcement by the president, of course, is a key step, but legislation will need to be amended. As you know, Section 7 of the NPA Act needs to be amended, as well as not, it's not just about the permanent, it's also about the expanded powers, particularly amending Section 30 of the NPA Act. But we did report to this committee that last year we took the decision in the hope that this was going to happen, but also in the knowledge that corruption was going to take a long time to deal with. We did create the IED as a permanent structure through our own organizational design processes. So we've got a bit of a head start on that. The adverts have gone out. There've been, I think, over 80 positions that have been advertised. These positions are part of this move towards permanence, and we're in the process of filling them. Of course, now that the announcement's been made by the president, including the expanded powers, we need to really move that process forward to create what is essentially a new entity within the NPA, an expanded entity with these additional powers that will require new product protocols, new procedures, and of course, sort of, you know, very important changes in how the IED operates within the NPA. But we've just come out of the IED strat plan last week where this was discussed. So there is an operational work plan that is being developed. Our intention, of course, is as soon as the legislation is amended, and I know the minister is committed to that process, to expediting it. I think Honourable Swart said, what can this committee do? It would be really good to expedite that process, particularly the amendments of Section 7 and Section 30 of the NPA Act, so that we can move ahead full steam with the permanent and expanded IED process. But as I say, we haven't waited for this moment. We've been working on it for some time. The question on, sorry, I'm just, my own handwriting is terrible. The German funding, Chair, no, the NPA has engaged with Germany on lots of different levels, at an operational level, as Advocate de Kock mentioned. We've also gone on a number of exchange visits and study tours over the years. In terms of actual funding from the German government, there is a discussion that we're having with National Treasury and the German government for a multi-year capacity building initiative, but that funding will not come to the National Prosecuting Authority. It will go through National Treasury according to the prescripts that have to be followed and to protect the NPA's independence, but that negotiation is still in process, but it will be managed by National Treasury, and the money will be allocated to the NPA through the normal fiscal process through the RDP fund. This is reported in our annual report and will continue to be so moving forward. The second last question, quickly, Chair, you asked on the aspirant prosecutors program, vitally important question in terms of all the initiatives we have to bring the right people into the organization. There is an in-depth negotiation and process underway to amend the Legal Practice Act and the associated amendments that are required to the NPA Act. We cannot look at an accreditation of the aspirant prosecutors program before the LPC until that amendment, those amendments happen. And there are many of those amendments that are going to give a higher status to prosecutors within the legal profession, largely through amendments that we're proposing to the NPA Act, but of course also some amendments to the Legal Practice Act. And then obviously an in-depth engagement with the LPC to make sure that level of status of prosecutors, including our aspirants, is elevated, including through the recognition or the accreditation of the aspirants through the LPC. The last question the Chair asked, which is a difficult one to answer, 99% expenditure against 71% performance. Mm-hmm. I could do what I suppose government departments use, blame it on the performance indicators and say that perhaps we set them too high. But I think it is perhaps a difficult comparison to make because we don't work in a scientific space where 100% means 100%. I think Advocate de Kock made the point that 71% compliance with our performance indicators at this level is tracking historical trends of the NPA and certainly is an improvement on previous years. It also tracks international trends. But I think it does call into question the larger issue around our performance indicators and whether or not they are 100% useful in terms of the broader questions we should be asking ourselves. Are we making South Africans safer? Are we a better investment climate? So perhaps, Chair, you've sparked an important discussion as to whether or not those indicators are the right ones. But let me stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Dr. C. Advocate Cock, are you ready to deal with
yes, any related issues? Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You're still muted?
No.
And after that, Andrea, you can, Advocate Johnson can deal with the judicial lab issue, and then Advocate Mohatra has one issue. Please go ahead, Advocate Cock.
Thank you very much, NDPP. Thank you, Chair. There was a question relating to the SECU cases. And this question raised the statement we made that only 10% of our cases are finalized within 9 months in our various SECUs. So the question was, what other concrete initiatives are being planned? Well, this is work in progress. As we know, we established 18 more SECUs out the country. I think it's important and it's very significant to note that before, our SECUs were only in the largest centers in the country. Since we started this initiative last year, we now have SECUs represented in all the provinces in our country. That's significant. And we have gone on an evaluation of the actual court rolls to understand where the greatest demand is, and hence the initiative to increase SECUs at those centers where additional SECUs are required. So that is the first one. The second one is that we've reviewed the manner in which we enroll cases within our SECUs. There was a period in our history in the prosecution that our SECU colleagues were given numbers, targets to achieve. We've moved away from that completely, where we have now said that we want to make impact and we want to prosecute complex, truly complex and serious commercial and corruption work. So there's a general shift. But of course, the court rolls are congested, and that remains our challenge. An additional initiative that we've taken is to enroll cases in our high courts. And we've demonstrated recently that more and more cases that would have previously have been enrolled in the SECU courts are now being enrolled in the high court. The third initiative relates to our interaction with the judiciary. Now, the judiciary is responsible to case manage our cases on our court rolls. And of course, that is an onerous responsibility because the court has to weigh up all the competing rights of the accused and the state, particularly in criminal matters, in dealing with matters. And so we're competing for time, we're competing for resources on our court rolls, and there is a massive challenge with our court rolls being overcrowded. So we have engaged, as I've indicated earlier, with the National Efficiency Committee of the Chief Justice. This committee has been resuscitated by the Chief Justice. Two meetings have been held recently. And one of the things that we will look at is how better to manage cases through the courts into the future. But I emphasize again that the finalization of court work is going to be as a result of both the active participation of the lawyers for accused persons and for the prosecutors who represent the state. This is not a one-sided issue. And so as an example, when lawyers are bringing thousands and thousands of interlocutory applications to delay cases on our court rolls, we need to think about that. We need to think about what is it doing to the system when cases cannot move, when on a regular basis lawyers are bringing all sorts of applications to delay the progress of cases on our court rolls. And I say that unequivocally, that in many instances these applications are being brought to delay cases from progressing on our court rolls. So the MPA has briefed senior counsel to also look at how to deal with this question of delays that arise because of various interlocutory applications that are brought, in particular in relation to complex commercial and complex corruption cases. Our senior counsel has recently produced a document. We are looking at that very carefully, and we are then also looking at the kind of approach that our prosecutors must consistently follow in terms of opposing interlocutory applications, where it's justified to oppose it, and also to insist that prosecutions must proceed so that we can avoid these delays from proceeding. But I think that perhaps the committee could also assist us with this question, because perhaps it is time that we must review the Criminal Procedure Act. I know that we've been talking for a long time about the commission, the Law Commission, looking at the Criminal Procedure Act. But I think that we need to perhaps consider, are the other measures that that we need to introduce in order to speed up the process of cases on our court rolls. But just finally, the Chief Justice has indicated to the MPA and to the National Director that in order for us to deal specifically with the question of commercial and corruption matters, we must engage with the judge presidents of each of our divisions. And we've already issued a directive to all our DPPs to do that. So I think that we're going to try and do this on a more case-specific basis. We will look at the cases that will give us the greatest impact, try to advance those cases on our court rolls as best we can, in collaboration with the legal profession, and of course, ultimately, under the direction of the court itself. The MPA remains a participant in the criminal justice system. We are not in control of the way in which cases are finalized on our court rolls. As far as the issue relating, there was a question relating to the number of government officials convicted of corruption. The target has not been met in this regard. It also speaks to the way in which the MPA sometimes sets its targets. We will review that in the upcoming strategic review of the MPA in November. But just to mention that if we go to slide 11, you will notice that there was, in fact, an increase of 51% on the number of government officials that were convicted. I think that demonstrates that a lot of work is going into that specific area. And 44 more officials were convicted during the reporting period. The other significant issue to recognize here is this was also linked previously to the work of the SECU, where the target was set according to numbers of people convicted. We have since changed the focus of the work of the SECU to deal with more highly complex work. And this is also impacted on the number of ordinary corruption matters involving government officials that are being brought. We want to really make a case in terms of the broader corruption work and the broader complex commercial work. And so we will review this as well as part of the process of review within the MPA. The last aspect that I wanted to touch on was the question of organized crime. As far as organized crime is concerned, here we are in partnership with the police. The police are mandated to investigate organized crime and to ensure that cases are brought to the prosecution for prosecution. Now, the first important initiative that we are currently strengthening with the police, and in particular the DPCI, is our ability to work collaboratively with each other. We've identified that there is no holistic organized crime strategy that has been crafted, and we have recognized as the MPA that it's time that we ensure that holistic organized crime strategy is crafted. What we do have, we have various strategies to deal with specific aspects of organized crime. So we have, for example, a gang strategy dealing particularly with gangs. We've got strategies dealing with rail theft, non-ferrous metal thefts. We've got strategies dealing with Eskom and the challenges in relation to Eskom, etc. but we don't have an overarching strategy to deal with organized crime in particular. And we feel that in the light of the Global Initiative report, which was presented to the MPA management team not so long ago, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, one of the key points that came out of that discussion was that we will engage our police counterparts to develop this in consultation with some of the external experts in this field, and we will then drive urgently to ensure that we can develop a coordinated organized crime strategy for the country. In the interim, at an operational level, we do our best to focus on specific crime types, like the one dealing with essential infrastructure. We also have another initiative looking at ESCOM, where we are now looking at all the cases that have been referred for investigation so that we can double up and ensure that those investigations can be finalized as speedily as possible and bring perpetrators to court. So there's various initiatives that we're dealing specifically with specific offenses, but the idea must be that we need to look at it holistically and see that how do we bring down the ability of organized crime to feature within our country and to take root within our country. So all of that is interrelated. NDPP, I'm not sure if there are, I think there's one question relating to the bail of a person. I'm not sure of the details of this particular question. I think we'll have to give a written response after we obtain the information from the relevant Director of Public Prosecution. So with the permission of yourself and the chairperson, if we can give a written response to that particular question. And there was a question, I think the last one related to the murders, the 3,600 murders that we flighted. Just to say that the MPA is very concerned about the murder rate in the country and the increasing murder rate in the country. We have recently engaged with the National Commissioner's Office, and we have set up a particular initiative to look at how best do we address this collectively between ourselves and the police to ensure that cases, that we are able to bring the murder rate down. One of those initiatives is going to be dealing with dockets that are not getting relevant attention at police stations. What we want to do is to identify the police stations with the highest numbers of murders and for prosecutors and investigators to look at all of those dockets. I think that there are so many dockets that have been opened at police stations that are just not getting attention. So that is one of the initiatives that we want to enhance to ensure that we play our part in preventing murders from happening going forward. The other initiative that I think is key to this is our community prosecutions initiative. So the MPA has established a community prosecution initiative as reported earlier. The implementation or the further implementation of that initiative is going to be the next phase of the work of the MPA. And I think that one of the areas that we have to identify in terms of community prosecution is serious violent crime. And so we're going to have to work very closely with partners. We're going to have to work with the police in terms of reactive investigations, but we're also going to have to work with our communities in terms of preventing crimes and particularly serious violent crime from happening in the first place. We're going to have to work with local councillors. We're going to have to work with NGOs. We're going to have to work with municipalities. So this is the whole process of the community prosecutions. And we hope that that will also bring about a change in the crime rate. And finally, I think the implementation of the crime prevention strategy is something that we also spoke about when we had the presentation of the Global Initiative. And we feel that more can be done by the country to deal with the crime prevention strategy. And so these are some of the things that we will be speaking with our partners about in order to address the murder and other serious violent crime in the country. Thank you very much, NDPP and Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Advocate Cock. Advocate Johnson, I know you're online, but I understand that you have a poor line. Can you try and see if you're able to deal with some of the questions? I'm not hearing Advocate Johnson. Okay, whilst we're trying to connect Chair, whilst we're trying to connect, we will take one other question relating to the State Attorney, and then we'll come back to the ID issues. Advocate Mohatla will deal with those issues, Chair.
Good afternoon, members, Chairperson. Thank you, NDPP. I will deal with a question from Honorable Swart regarding the relationship with the state attorneys and the increase in the default judgment. I would start by saying that it's not only an NPA problem, it's an issue that all government departments have. But since you've asked the question, I will answer it. I would say that I would have said that I have a lawyer in the state attorney. That question should be answered by the Solicitor General, but I will answer it. And also because we really want to be independent, and in the near future, we'll be doing our own matters. And so NPA has done this in order to address those issues that have been raised. The first one, I would say that the NPA has reached out to the Solicitor General to ask of the Solicitor General to increase the capacity within the state attorney's offices in order to at least dedicate certain members or officials of the state attorneys to deal with NPA matters, because we are representing about 60% of the matters that the state attorney is dealing with countrywide. So in that regard, an MOU was signed between the NDPP and the NPA and the Solicitor General, which enjoys the backing and the support of the minister. So the MOU speaks about increasing that capacity by increasing the establishment of the state attorneys countrywide, and those people will then in turn be placed in the DPP's offices to service the NPA in the regions in real time. Internally, what we have done is to go through a work study which has been approved, and out of that work study we have identified that we need to increase the capacity of the Legal Affairs Division. People will be placed in the regions. We're looking at 35 more personnel to be placed in the regions. And in doing so, the further processes will then unfold, which include the decentralization of the services that have been offered at VGM office. They will now be afforded, provided at regional level, under the leadership of the DPP's offices, and head office will then deal with the matters that are only relating to head office and certain specialized divisions. Over and above that, the IG and the AFU requires highly skilled attorneys and professionals to deal with their matters. So in that regard, we have asked of the Solicitor General to give us some of his delegations so that some of the NPA officials would be able to provide the ID and the AFU with the state attorney services. We are proud to say that in the meeting of last week between the SD, the NDPP and the minister, that an agreement was then clinched, and we are hoping that we will be getting those delegations probably this week, if not late. I'm hoping that it's on its way coming to us. I'm also proud to indicate that the added funding that has been provided to NPA has afforded us an opportunity to go through a tender process, which has been finalized, and now the supply chain has gone out to a market to look for a digitized system, which will enable us to be able to link up the NPA processes and programs with that of the state attorney to avoid duplications of matters, to avoid certain matters being lost through the cracks. And I'm also proud to mention that the MOU that the NPA has signed recently with the Business Leadership South Africa has afforded us an opportunity to get an expert who's going to look at
who's already looking at our processes and ensuring that we, it's one of the big firms. I don't know if I should mention the name. Let me not. the experts are already in our premises, and they are going through our processes to ensure that we can compete with the big guns out there. And we are anticipating that a lot of challenges are going to come out of the matters, the state capture matters and the corruption matters that are being dealt with. We anticipated the Stalingrad tactics, and we definitely need to have a hands-on state attorney. We need to have hands-on counsel who are going to deal with our matters. And maybe let me not go further, but I'd really like to tell South Africans that we are really doing our best to look at opportunities and ways to talk to our counterparts, our stakeholders, so that we can, look at ways of getting proper counsel on board to assist us with our AFU and ID matters, to deal with state capture matters. Thank you, NDPP.
Thank you very much, Advocate Mokhatla. I think Advocate Johnson is connected now. Advocate Johnson, can you please take the floor? I know you're traveling, so hopefully you're able to deal with this.
Thank you, NDPP. Honorable members, that is fine. Honorable members, Honorable Chair, NDPP and the leadership of the NPA, on a response to the question asked by the Honorable Swart, With regards the IT and the Zondo resources, we have already been in communication with Professor Mosala from the Zondo Commission. These engagements commenced in March of this year. Much work has been done in order to first understand what the database comprises of, both in terms of its hardware and software. And I must say, honorable members, it is quite an impressive piece of equipment, but there's a lot of upgrading to be done, both in terms of the hardware and software. The NPA is engaged in terms of all the IT specs and is in the process of procuring what it needs to set up its digital lab in the NPA premises in Silverton. We have also been able to onboard the staff that were at Zondo. These would in the main be those that access the data, do the data analysis, as well as the key person who was the only person who had the key access to all of the Zondo data. They are currently in the ID space, Honorable Chair, and in fact, we received confirmation yesterday that all their contracts, that is 14 of them, will be extended for a further period of 12 months. In addition, we are still in engagement with Professor Mosala, who engages the Office of the Minister of Justice to indicate that it might be best for the hardware, now that the Honorable Judge has presented his final report, that all of the data, its data center, the database, resort under the NPA, so that the ID has unrestricted access and is still, however, able to allow access to other law enforcement agencies and interested parties, albeit that same must be very controlled so that data is not compromised and or that there's no unauthorized access. NDPP, thank you. Honorable Chair and members, I thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Johnson. Advocate Kopp, there was a question relating to the lease of the VGM premises. If you can just, the month-to-month versus where we are with that and any financial implications.
Is that question not directed to Advocate
Duplessis? Yeah, don't worry, Rodney. I've got it. Okay, thanks, Honorable Chair. Yeah, that question on the lease, just so you know that we no longer on a month-to-month lease. That changed more than a year ago. We're now on another five-year lease. And the reason why it was a month-to-month lease for so long was because of complicated negotiations with DPWI on Robosis to include the soft services in the current contract that we have. So you'll be pleased to know we are no longer on a month-to-month contract with VGM. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate Duplessis. Chair, there's just a few matters that I would like to deal with to wrap up, and those that have not been addressed, or just highlighting a few things. Chair, you asked the question about whether we have considered any whether any staff members I hope I got your question right about contraventions of Section 32 of the NPA Act, which essentially deals with the requirement that NPA staff members must act independently and in good faith. And then 32.1b dealing with any interference in the work of the NPA, and that these are criminal offences in terms of the Act. Chair, we will respond. I want to make sure we get all the correct information to Parliament. We will respond in writing to that, as well as one or two other questions that you raised regarding statistics. But on this particular issue, Chair, the committee has my and the Exco's full commitment and we give the assurance that prosecutors who do not act in accordance with Section 32.1a of the NPA Act will be dealt with in terms of either disciplinary processes or criminal prosecutions, as well as any interference with the work of the NPA. With regard to 32.1b, we are in accordance with the Rodriguez judgment. We have informed the minister that we will be appointing counsel to look at the all of the initiatives and efforts that the NPA is making to deal with the TRC matters and any possible interference in the work of the NPA. Chair, the other questions that you asked relating to statistics, we will respond to in writing. Chair, I just want to highlight, Advocate de Kock did cover the issue of organized crime quite comprehensively, but I want to make the point, Chair and Honourable Members, that in order to deal effectively with organized crime, you have to have a very effective crime intelligence capacity. There is no other way of dealing with effectively with organized crime if we do not have a highly efficient, uncompromised crime intelligence division acting with the highest standards of skills and integrity. If we deal with, we also got to look at levels of corruption within law enforcement, and how this affects the ability of law enforcement to deal with organized crime. You know, the global index for organized crime was referred to, and as Advocate de Kock said, we invited the authors of that that particular, well, the research, those the entity that conducted the research, to come and present to us and our MANCO, and also to the JCPS Minister's retreat because of the importance. The point is that we will not be able to deal with organized crime effectively if we do not have, as I said, really good crime intelligence, if we do not have law enforcement capacities that are not compromised and that act with the highest standards of integrity. You know, even kidnappings are a sign it's an organized crime phenomenon. And all of these, you know, I mean, the NPA is not sitting back as a passive passenger in this. We realize that we need to work closely, and that is why we've been engaging with external partners and also now with our colleagues in the SAFs to try to really become more focused in terms of how we deal with various types of organized crimes matters in a collaborative way. But at the end of the day, you know, we joined with the SAFs at the hip, and we do require all of the capacities, capabilities, in the SAPS before we can deal with these issues in the way that we should. I don't think it's a good, it is a poor reflection on our country if it is regarded as a haven for organized criminals. So that's something, you know, a lot of work needs to go into that issue. The issue of holding seniors to account, we are aware, and there's also been, you know, media reports about one DPP, and processes relating to a DPP, as well as certain senior members of the NPA. I want to say that these processes are at an advanced stage. There have been engagements with the staff members concerned, formal engagements. We've received responses. There have also been engagements with unions, with legal representatives. We've received responses from staff members, and my understanding is that some of these matters have been set down for December and January. That sounds okay. Thank you, Chair. December and January. On the issue of women getting support, I agree completely with Honourable Maseko Jele. You know, we are very, very serious about really empowering women in the NPA, particularly in senior leadership levels. And I'm really proud that we have got women, not simply because they're women, but because they are highly skilled and that they come with high standards of integrity, and they are really, really, experts in their field. And so I feel that, and we give them all the support. And we're also trying to empower women at the lower levels in the organization so that they can come through and take up leadership levels moving forward. Chair, on the issue of, I want to say to Honorable Maseko Jele that I was also quite astounded when I read in the media that the perpetrator, the one who's accused of killing the young four-year-old child in the most brutal way, was out on bail with regard to another rape matter. And I've asked for a report on that, and once we receive it, we will send the report on to this committee. Chair, there's one other issue on the TCCs and the numbers. I'm going to just ask Advocate de Kock if he's got an update on that, that he can update this committee on very quickly before I deal with one or two remaining questions. Advocate de Kock, do you have those numbers on the TCCs?
So the TCC number for this financial year is 62. So we'll have an additional two TCCs added during this financial year.
Thank you very much. Chair, I want to add that the work that's currently being done under the new special director in the SOCA unit, Advocate Bonnie Curry Gamwell, has been absolutely astounding, and her team. We are working very, very closely with the private sector in order to ensure that the existing TCCs all are upgraded. Those that require refurbishments, it's been done. We've had incredible support from the private sector. We are also working with the private sector to set up new TCCs in various areas. And in fact, the one TCC that I think will be launched in November in Limpopo it's a new model for TCCs. In the past, these have always been a space within a hospital, and I must now acknowledge the work of all our partners in the space of sexual and gender-based crimes. We deal with so many different, besides the police and the normal government partners, we deal with so many NGOs that help us with supporting victims and survivors of sexual and gender-based crimes, even at the TCCs, with the Department of Health. I really want to acknowledge all of the role players that help in this process. But the model, the TCC in Limpopo is a new model, as I said. It's the first one where, together with the private sector donation, we're having a new TCC built from ground level. So, it's incredibly exciting, and it's at roof level, and we're hoping that will be launched in November. But we're really trying to push the number of TCCs that we have. We're also working with the SAPS Forensic Services Division and looking at all the help desks and trying to see how we could link these help desks in the SAPS stations to TCC centers. So there's a lot of good work happening in that space, and we will be able to update the committee on that. I think there's just one other outstanding issue that was raised. The issue of impunity that was raised by Honorable Breitenbach, just to say that, we agree that it's hugely important for, convictions and for people to be, for the consequences of criminal conduct and for people to be imprisoned. But that is not the only, measure of whether we are winning in the battle to end impunity. The very fact that people are being arrested,
shows that impunity is no longer a given. And the very fact that people now are not confident about the fact that they will never be arrested, the very fact that people now would be wondering about when, not whether, but when the knock on that door will come, is an important step in the fight against impunity. And so even though people may not be physically incarcerated now, and we are really doing everything we can to deal with all of the Stalingrad tactics, etc., it will happen. But people, I am sure, would be mentally incarcerated just wondering about when that knock on the door is going to come. And that in itself is a consequence. Chair, there was one, I think, question by Honorable Yako about, it was a difficult one in terms of, you know, why, what are the root causes and why do we have such high levels of criminality, particularly corruption, and, you know, the political involvement, and why do South Africans as a nation, why do we feel that we can get away with it? For a long time, South Africans were very comfortable in the thought that they could get away with corruption in particular, because there was no will, and because of the capture of many state institutions, prosecutions were not taking place. But if one, the tide is changing, and if one really has to consider what is the root cause of corruption, it is really in a lack of good governance and a lack of ethical leadership. And if we want to ensure, you know, we're not going to, I've said this before, we're not going to be able to prosecute ourselves out of corruption. It is really important that the preventative steps, that we ensure that there are systems and processes put in place that make it very, very difficult, that we've got to ensure good governance, we've got to ensure ethical leadership. And so I think those are, that's as far as I can take that question. Chair, I think we have responded to most of the questions. Those that we haven't, we will respond to in writing, unless there's anyone in particular the chair would like us to deal with at this point.
Yeah, no, just I think one issue that I think we did not raise is the issue of optimum case.
Optimum coal mines.
Optimum coal mines, yes. How far are you? And there is a view, in fact, people, some of them are really scared that they might lose their jobs, and what is being done to ensure that during the process, people do not lose jobs in their thousands.
Thank you, Chair. I'll ask Advocate Rabaji Rastava to deal with, but just to advise committee members that we have been engaging with various stakeholders with regard to numerous issues, and Advocate Rabaji would be able to update the committee on that. Slide in and then just put the video on when we get there.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the question. As previously advised, we have met with MUM representing the employees of the mine. We have met with the Steve Chwete community members. We have met with other NGOs from the community. And when we argued the preservation application, for the preservation application of the mine, by that time, NUM had intervened as a party to the proceedings, and both the NDPP and NUM filed a joint practice note where we have emphasized in the joint practice note that if anything, we are trying to do the opposite of people losing their jobs. What we are trying to do is to get the mine forfeited to the state, and then it will be sold at market value so that the other members of the community who lost their jobs, because there are people who are out of employment as soon as the mine was placed under business rescue in the hands of the Gupta's in 2018.
So we want to make sure that those people also get their jobs back. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Are there any other issues that the Chair would like us to deal with?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. No, thank you very much for the briefing. And also, I think I will be speaking on behalf of the committee to say, no, we are pleased with the improvements. It's a beginning of a long road, as Honorable Breitenbach has said. Our aim is to try and ensure that by end of our term, your target against, your performance against targets is 80%, which is supposed to be the standard, it's a standard set by the presidency. But we are really pleased that there is a movement, and from the report it's quite clear that there is still this long road that must be traveled. We thought that it would be important that we inform you that as a committee we took a decision, having listened to a lot of institutions reporting to the committee, you have issues that cut across, sometimes that affect, for instance, you have state attorney, state attorney, NPA, you would have IR, information regulator, department, you have issues that you did not raise, but I think where you said you would want a TDG to facilitate, a position of a TDG to facilitate a better coordination in terms of delegations of powers for administrative purposes. So what we have decided to do is to have a physical meeting where all the entities that report to the committee will be part of that meeting together with the DGs and the national commissioners and the minister. What we want is that each entity prepares for that meeting as to what are the issues that they would want an urgent resolution to them as a matter of urgency. This is what we would want to leave behind, as most of these admin issues, and some of them are complex, but we would want to deal with them once and for all. So we would call that meeting. It would be in Pretoria, I think. Yes, it will be in Pretoria, where all of us would be under one roof. We would also, from the responses that we have received, from the questions and the responses that we have received, is to have quarterly meetings. And in those quarterly meetings, we will ensure that we do not meet during the time when the House is sitting. We should have, because we are trying to narrow the, because we have outstanding matters with yourselves, and SIU and the Hawks. We've got outstanding matters with yourself with respect to the TRC cases. So we would want those quarterly meetings to be consolidated so that you don't have to come many times to report to the committee. And we try to consolidate them. But also from the responses, there are other issues that we think that they need more time for us to engage with yourselves. But we are, from the report that you have given us on the grey listing matter, it makes us to be cautiously optimistic that some work has been done. But something that does not affect you, we are generally concerned with the terrorist financing bill, because I think it is still in the National Assembly. It will have to go to the NCOP and go to the president. So I don't think that February would meet that target of as a country we would meet that target of February. I'm not sure what are the implications of that, but I think holistically, the report that you have given, but we don't know what they will be looking at, but it makes us at least to be cautiously optimistic that the state of affairs in 2020, there has been some improvement. But Honorable Swartz did raise an issue that I think part of the evaluation happened in 2020, not in 2019. It was one in 2019, one in 2020. But I think let's keep our fingers crossed that we would not be grey listed. And if we do, let's ensure like Mauritius that we are able to come back much quicker and not take more than 24 months. So we need to, maybe it's something that as Parliament, we might need to try and get a coordinated briefing as to what is being done, what is going to be done. And even if we are not grey listed, but that will not be the only and the last evaluation. How should we make sure that we are not grey listed at all? If we are grey listed, how do we get out of it as soon as possible? But thank you very much. Thank you very much, NDPP, and to your team. I think the last word is to congratulate all the prosecutors who are lawyers for the people. I like the United States concept. They don't say state versus, it's the people versus. So a prosecutor is the lawyer of the people, for the people. It's not an easy job. It's a very difficult job. Trying, proving beyond reasonable doubt, the case beyond reasonable doubt is not an easy, it's not an easy thing, but they are there. They are the soldiers on the ground who ensure that those cases are proved beyond reasonable doubt to all of them, and the auxiliary services and the NPA that supports them, we would like to salute them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, for your ongoing support and guidance. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Members. We'll meet tomorrow at 9:30. The meeting is adjourned.